Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilow. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about sexuality, intimacy, and menopause with Dr. Elena Ratner. Dr. Ratner is assistant professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
So, Elena, can you start out by just giving us a little bit of background about yourself and telling us how you ended up specializing in gynecologic oncology?
Sure. So my path to gynecologic oncology was kind of a natural one. I come from a long family of doctors. My mom and my dad and my grandmother and even my grand-grandmother were physicians. But not just doctors, but also strong, independent women. I studied women's studies at college, and I always knew that those two passions, taking care of women and medicine, will at some point combine, and they have beautifully and naturally in this subspecialty, which I think is the best subspecialty.
So do you actually treat the cancer in your female patients, or?
I do. So the beauty of this subspecialty is that I'm able to take care of my patient from the very first day when she gets diagnosed with the cancer, through her surgery, through her chemotherapy, and through her treatment, and then through her wonderful life afterwards. I'm also able to treat her children, her daughters, and her granddaughters. So it truly allows me a very comprehensive, very personal care relationship with my patients. Hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what the different types of gynecologic cancers are and how patients actually get referred to your practice?
Sure. So in gynecologic oncology, we take care of women with ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, cervical cancer, cancer of the vagina or the vulva. But we also take care of a lot of women who do not have cancer, women who have precancerous conditions, again, of the cervix or of the uterus. I also, one of my passions is early detection and prevention of cancer. Because I feel that in 2014, a lot of conversation should be really about cancer prevention rather than treatment. So I have a big population of women who have either BRCA mutations or for some other reason they are at higher risk for developing ovarian cancer or uterine cancer.
What's that BRCA thing? I don't know what that is.
Thank you. That's a great point. So there's BRCA is a mutation. It's called BRCA mutation. And among other mutations, it increases the chance that the women would develop different cancers, including ovarian cancer or breast cancer. So a lot nowadays is being done about cancer prevention, and a huge part of it is genetics. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to identify those women who we think would be at higher risk for developing those cancers.
So should I be having my wife and daughter screen for that gene? That's really scary.
You know, it's a complicated question. You're also talking to somebody who's biased because this is very much my research and my passion. Not everybody, of course, needs to be tested for those genes, but women who either carry family history of these cancers or for some other different risk factors would be considered at high risk. They definitely need to be evaluated and be seen by a geneticist to determine whether they need to be tested.
So if your grandmother had breast cancer or an aunt or great aunt, is that sufficient or... Like, when should somebody be worried, I guess,
yeah.
is what I'm asking.
You know, I think nobody should be worried, but I think people should take it seriously. And I think this is all part of this new thinking. The new thinking is that cancers should be prevented. You know, we work so hard in trying to find cancers early. And, of course, that's a huge part of it. And I think that we need to continue working on that. But a bigger part of it even needs to be that we should try to prevent them.
Along those lines, there's a lot of scare now about HPV because we have this HPV vaccine that we're giving to our younger people. Can you talk a little bit about that as a potential preventive malignancy? And, you know, do you think that all of our teenagers should be getting that vaccine?
Yeah, absolutely. So HPV vaccine is a great example. That's a successful example of something that can be done to try to prevent HPV virus.
That's the papillomavirus? Is that what that is?
That's a human papillomavirus.
Okay.
And we know the different strands of that virus could predispose women to developing cervical precancerous condition and cervical cancers. So yes, right now the recommendation and my personal opinion that all girls, right now the recommendation is from age 9 to 26, hopefully before first sexual experience, should be vaccinated with the vaccine.
The HPV, is that the same as warts? Is that genital warts?
So the genital warts is also HPV, but it's a different one.
Oh.
The warts actually are not truly precancerous, and they actually do not progress to cervical cancer. They are caused by something called low-risk HPV virus versus high-risk HPV virus that is truly precancerous and can cause cervical cancer.
So any of our listeners who happen to have genital warts don't need to particularly be worried about that. But they should probably still be seeing their GYN, I guess, huh?
That's correct.
Can you talk about how frequent these GYN cancers are, and is the incidence of these cancers going up or down now that you're talking about screening, hopefully down in the future, but what's happening right now?
So right now we are at this place where we're discovering a lot of new information. So it's a little bit too early at this point to really see the fruits of these discoveries. But I think looking forward, looking 10 to 20 years from now, you know, when my kids are going to be the age of where they would be developing these cancers, I do truly feel that we are going to see significantly decreased incidence of these cancers.
Hmm. And I know that this probably isn't your disease area, but I'm sure many of your patients ask you, there's been a lot of scare about whether mammography is really helping or not helping and increased radiation risk. And what's your take on that about screening mammograms since we're talking about prevention?
You know, again, citing that I'm biased, you're talking to an oncologist whose job and whose passion is to prevent cancers. I think everything in life and everything in medicine has its risks and has its benefits. I believe that mammograms unquestionably have much more benefits than they do the risks. And breast cancer is one of those cancers that actually can be detected early, and that's why the outcomes could be very, very good. So I think not doing the mammograms would lose that advantage of being able to diagnose those cancers early.
And likewise, could you just reiterate for us the necessity for the Pap smears? And are we still talking about getting those every year? And are there certain populations that need them more often or less often than that?
So the guidelines for Pap smears have changed significantly over the past 5 to 7 years. You know, when I talk to my patients about Pap smears, I talk about how these guidelines are really more for the well-being of society and not necessarily on individual patients. In my practice, I very much address every patient very individually. There are some women who do not need it every year. There's a lot of women who can stay with the guidelines and get it every other year, or even less frequently if HPV status is checked. But there's a lot of women that I do not follow the guidelines, and I do get it every year if I'm worried that they would be at a higher risk of developing malignancy or premalignancy.
Some of the cancers that you deal with, say endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer, can be difficult to detect. I wonder if you could talk to us about ways of preventing those cancers.
Right. So that's exactly the problem. Endometrial cancer is a bit easier because with endometrial cancer, you usually would have symptoms when the cancer is first discovered. Usually you would have bleeding, and any woman who has any vaginal bleeding after her menopause needs to see a physician because that is never, never normal. And So usually when these women have bleeding, they present to their provider, they get a biopsy, and usually endometrial cancers also get diagnosed early. Ovarian cancer, that's the challenging cancer. That's unfortunately the cancer for which there is no effective early detection. I have, as I mentioned, a whole program in which I deal only with this early detection prevention of ovarian cancer, partly by identifying women who are at high risk, but partly just monitoring daughters and granddaughters of my patients who have developed ovarian cancer. There's a lot of literature about what can be done, like ultrasounds twice a year, like blood tests for tumor markers. However, none of them really have been found to be effective, definitely not as effective as pap smears for cervical cancer or as mammograms for breast cancer.
So what do you recommend to these offspring of people who've had ovarian cancer or who have a positive history or this BRCA gene or something like that?
That's where it gets very complicated. And that's why it's so important to really correctly identify the women who are at risk. Because if women do carry a genetic predisposition to developing ovarian cancer, then we have specific guidelines for what needs to be done. It does not always need to be surgery, or it doesn't have to be surgery till later age, but those women are watched very, very closely.
I hope we don't have a lot of nervous people in the audience now after hearing this. can you just tell us the frequency of these women who have the genetic predisposition? You know, how common is that?
Yeah, so I think the opposite. I think if anybody is nervous about it, this talk should actually do the opposite. Because I think what we're talking today is all those things that we're doing to prevent cancers and all these new modalities and all these new programs that we're establishing so cancers don't develop. So ovarian cancer is very, very rare, 1.4% in general population. BRCA gene, even though now we think is a little bit more frequent, is still very, very rare. So I think that this definitely should not make women nervous, but on the contrary.
And are there, you said that there were non-surgical interventions that can be used for people who are deemed to be at high risk for ovarian cancer? Is that just frequent exams, or are there medicines they can take?
So there are. Again, every patient is seen very, very individually. You know, everything has its pluses, its minuses. Birth control pills have found to significantly decrease risk of breast cancer, risk of ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. So women who have used birth control pills for, let's say, 5 years during their life have a decrease in ovarian cancer by as high as 50%.
Wow.
So very, very high, very, very high reduction. And for women who have these different mutations that would predispose them to ovarian cancer, there's very specific guidelines for when prophylactic, or we call it risk-reducing surgery, would be recommended.
What about with endometrial cancer and those same types of hormones? Does it increase or decrease the risk?
It does not increase it.
So that's good news for folks out there.
Absolutely.
Is that true for hormone replacement therapy as well? Is that I know that's a very controversial
area,
right?
That's very different.
So,
yeah. So for hormone replacement, if we can certainly touch on that. So hormone replacement therapy is when hormones are given to women after menopause. You guys know, a lot has changed over the past 10 years with the Women's Health Initiative study. But the bottom line is that women who are using just estrogen for their symptoms, who have previously had a hysterectomy and do not need additional progesterone, they are not at increase of breast cancer or really any other cancer.
Okay, well, we may want to get back to that after the break. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about sexuality, intimacy, and menopause with Dr. Elena Ratner.
Smoking can be a very strong habit that involves the potent drug nicotine, and there are many obstacles to face when quitting smoking. But smoking cessation is a very important lifestyle change, especially for patients undergoing cancer treatment. Quitting smoking has been shown to positively impact response to treatments and to decrease the likelihood that patients will develop second malignancies. Smoking cessation programs are currently being offered at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center and at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. The Smoking Cessation Service at Smilo operates on the principles of the U.S. Public Health Service Clinical Practice Guidelines. All treatment components are evidence-based, and therefore all patients are treated with FDA-approved first-line medications and smoking cessation counseling. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilo Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss, and our guest, Dr. Elena Ratner. We're discussing female cancers, or GYN cancers, as well as sexuality, intimacy, and menopause and the treatment of cancer. Dr. Ratner, before the break, we were starting to talk about hormone replacement therapy for people who are postmenopausal and whether that increased their risk of cancer. And maybe you can go into that a little more.
Absolutely. So as I started mentioning before, the Women's Health Initiative study made a lot of revelations about hormone replacement therapy. And when that study was published, a lot has changed in our use of those hormones. So nowadays, we really use hormone replacement therapy only for symptoms, not routinely like we used to before that. And we also now use it really just for the time that you need to use it until the symptoms go away. But this the Women's Health Initiative study showed that combination of estrogen and progesterone did have an increased risk of breast cancer. The study is disputed by many people, by many subsequent publications, due to certain factors such as the age of the women was much higher. It was 63 average age, which is much higher than usually women are when they're on those hormones, and so forth. But a subsequent study from exactly the same population showed that if the women had a hysterectomy previously and did not need the progesterone to protect the uterus, their risk of breast cancer was not increased. And that is why in my population, even of cancer survivors, in many, many different circumstances, I'm very comfortable using estrogen for women who are symptomatic.
You mean just for hot flashes? Is that the main symptom?
So there's a lot of symptoms of menopause. Hot flashes is the one that usually comes to mind, but there's many more, and many are very complicated. So some of them are hot flashes, difficulty sleeping, mood changes. Some of it is cognitive changes, and that's actually the one that I see very frequently, where women after menopause complain of this brain fog. A lot of women here in the Yale community who are professors, who are they have a very hard time continuing with their teaching and their publications because they feel that their brain does not work as well as it did before menopause.
I feel like I have brain fog, but I don't have that excuse.
And the other things, of course, is sexual. You know, loss of desire, vaginal dryness are also very common symptoms.
Hmm. And how long do the women need to actually take this replacement therapy? Say the female professors, I might be one of those, by the way. but how many years do you actually need to continue on that? And are those changes reversible with time, or how does that evolve?
That's an excellent question. And sadly, I have no answer for you. It is very individual dependent. Some women are on it for a relatively short period of time, and then we try to decrease the dose, and they do well, and they carry on without anything. There's some that need it for a long, long time. You know, I have somebody who's in her 90s, and every time we try to decrease the hormones, she feels a difference, and for her, it's major quality of life, and we're continuing.
You talked about some of the sexuality issues that come with menopause, both in terms of libido or desire, as well as vaginal lubrication and stuff like that. Are there any particular sexuality issues around in cancer survivors or active cancer patients? Obviously, I guess if you've had GYN surgery, that may have all sorts of psychological, if not physical issues, but maybe you could go into that some.
Absolutely. You know, the reason why my other passion became the sexuality and intimacy is because it very much is not being addressed. You know, at major institutions like Yale, we do such a great job with treating cancers and curing people. But what we as providers consider successes, I find patients don't necessarily see it the same way. And I have met many women through the years who have been cured by us, whose lives were prolonged by our treatment, who return and continue to feel different and continue to feel that the treatment and the cancer has left damage that is not being addressed. And that's what brought me to this field of sexuality and intimacy and menopause, where I spend a lot of my time trying to help women who are either being treated for cancer right now or cancer survivors to help their quality of life, part of which is unquestionably sexuality and menopause. This affects many women. It really, you know, the age of my women ranges from 15. I have some girls who were child cancer survivors who are now trying to start being sexually active and have issues. And I have, and it ranges all the way to the 90s, where women continue to have vaginal dryness, and it interferes with their sex lives. And so it ranges all through the ages. It affects women with all kinds of cancers. A majority of my women who have these issues have ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, and a huge portion of these women are survivors of breast cancer.
Can you talk about the typical modalities such as hysterectomy and radiation therapy to the pelvis and how those specifically will affect sexual functioning?
Right. So these, the ones you mentioned, of course, are the biggest culprits. Women who had cervical cancer, who have had radical hysterectomies, who have had radiation to those areas, have significant vaginal dryness and loss of nerves and sensation. So that's a very specific group of women for whom we do a lot of very specific treatment. But then there's women who are on tamoxifen or on Arimidex. Women who don't.
What are those drugs?
So those are the drugs that are used in breast cancer for some women who either had breast cancer in the past or don't even have breast cancer. So those drugs is being used to prevent or decrease the risk of these women developing cancers in the future. But a lot of these drugs cause vaginal dryness as well as hot flashes and menopausal symptoms.
Oh, so the good news is you don't get cancer. The bad news is like you're miserable and you can't have a sex life. Is that right?
Exactly. So you just totally nailed it on the head. That's exactly what it is. And I feel like, again, in this
Why
day
would
and
I
age,
want that?
Well, I feel like in this day and age, we need to be able to address everything. You know, we no longer see a woman and we see her as this one specific problem that our specialty treats. I feel like women need to be seen as a complete human beings who have their lives, who have their desires, their mothers, their wives. You know, they get chemotherapy, they go home, and they want to have a normal life. And that's what we're here for.
So is there hope for these people in terms of their sexuality? What kinds of things can you do to help?
Absolutely. You know, we dedicate a lot of our time now and effort to create, again, very individual, very specific plans and treatments for these women. Some of them can have hormones, like we talked about before, and that helps a great deal. Some of them cannot. And for those women, we now created this comprehensive program where we use acupuncture and reflexology, and we have a special Zumba exercise class, and we use a lot of herbal medications. Big component of this practice is also therapy. We have found when I started this program together with Mary Jane Minkin years ago that the medical approach is only half of the battle, that a lot of this is psychological.
So psychotherapy, you mean?
Correct. So with the help of Dwayne Farron, who is a psychologist at Yale, and his interns, we're able to offer these women a very comprehensive approach where they're seen by a medical provider, but also by a special sex therapist. And it's not just for women. It's for couples. It's for husbands. Because this is not an individual problem. This affects the whole family and the couple.
And I was going to ask you what role I can imagine that if my wife or partner had had, you know, this cancer, this especially genital cancer of some variety, I just might be afraid to be sexually intimate with her, or afraid might make things worse, or I might hurt her, or I don't know. I mean, is there any disfiguration or anything like that I have to worry about, she has to worry about?
Yeah. So you just mentioned all those things. This is exactly the things that we hear from the husbands. You know, a lot of these cancers get diagnosed during intercourse. And then women, in addition to having to go through surgery and chemotherapy and treatment and all that, they also psychologically remember that this all happened when they had sex. And maybe she forgets, but the husband remembers. So a lot of the couples counseling that we do actually has to do with that, to try to separate the diagnosis from intimacy and from sexuality. We're actually quite successful in doing that.
And what about lesbian couples? I think we shouldn't disregard them, right? Are there issues there as well?
Absolutely. I think the most important thing that I would like to just get across today is that this is an incredibly common issue. Women who do not have cancer, 40 million of American women who do not have cancer have some sort of a female sexual dysfunction. In breast cancer population and gynecologic cancer population, that number is almost 90 to 97%.
Wow.
This is incredibly common, and I think very frequently, and now I talk to all my patients about it, I just bring it up, and I just tell them, you know what, this is so common, and if you're affected by it, you're not alone. And I think many times just hearing that allows the woman to be able to be more open about it, to be able to get the treatment, and to really just feel better that she's not alone in this and that treatments are available.
Do you find that it's hard for people to break down those barriers because it's not something that we're used to talking to doctors about?
Absolutely. And I think the doctors are probably as much to blame, if not more. I think we as providers do not talk about it enough, and we're not as comfortable talking about it. And I wasn't comfortable talking about it, and now I'm great at talking about it.
I can tell.
And I think part of it is just making the standard of care. You know, it's now totally part of my interview together with everything else. You know, I ask about smoking, I ask about everything else, and I ask about this because this is a normal part of life.
We're certainly, we've all been taught in the last 10 years as providers to assess pain scores on a regular basis, even if that's not their presenting symptom. Maybe we need to talk about sexuality scores, or at least to bring this into our comfort zone in terms of a routine discussion.
Exactly correct. You know, and I do a lot of teaching now to residents and to other providers. Exactly what you just said, just teaching them and making this commonplace and making this comfortable and just routine, because it is.
Elena, can you speak a little bit about drugs like Viagra and how they apply to women and female sexuality, and whether you use those kinds of drugs in your practice?
Yeah, so we do. You know, traditional remedies are not an option for women. For example, with breast cancer, when hormonal treatment can increase the risk of recurrence and we stay away from that, we then go into more alternative treatments. We use a lot of herbal medication. And Viagra is actually something that we use. It's not FDA approved for women. We use it completely off indication. But I have a lot of women who swear by it.
And I heard something about antidepressants being used for hot flashes. Is that still something that's used?
Absolutely. So again, you know, we use those in women, especially with breast cancer, for whom hormones cannot be used. After herbal medications, if those do not work enough, we use a lot of antidepressant medication. And actually, there's a lot of new ones that are even coming on the market that should be even better.
There's also some controversy about soy. You know, we've been talking back and forth about whether soy is good or not good. Yeah. Can you just touch a little bit on that data?
Yeah, you know, the scientist in me is not able to really give you an opinion because the studies really have not been great. What do I tell my patients? I tell my patients not to go crazy.
Dr. Elena Ratner is Assistant Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs from 2006 through the present are available in both audio and written versions at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support as part of the Connecting Our Communities initiative. And we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.